Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Wednesday, March 16th, 2016. Present today, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Gaddis, and myself, Co-Chair Thompson. Before we start, I'd like to remind members that cell phones and electronic devices are not allowed to be utilized in committee. And before, and Representative Guttenberg has joined us. Before we start, now that we are hearing personal legislation again, I want to remind members about process in this committee. The House Finance Committee will be working under rules set forth in Mason's Manual. I ask members to please review Chapter 10 and especially 12 of Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure that address decorum in debate. Please be aware that the chairs will be ensuring that the committee maintain decorum set forth in for committee work and debate. So we ask the members to adhere to the established rules as we move forward for the rest of the time that this committee meets. I will be reminding the others that are not here yet that we expect to start on time in this committee. There's too many times that we have been sitting here. Somebody comes in late and asks a question that's already been presented and answered or has already been presented in a PowerPoint presentation. This will not be allowed in the future. Also, members, please, direct questions are asked for. Keep them germane to the bill and not start leading us in another direction. And please be on time so that you know what has been answered already. Okay. On today's Representative Pruitt just joined us. On today's schedule, we will have first hearings on two bills, SB 53, Advanced Practice Registered Nurses, and SB 268, ADA, Dividend to State Income Valuation, and I do not intend to move either one of these bills today. Our first order of business is SB 53, Advanced Practice Registered Nurses. Here to present SB 53 is a sponsor, Senator Kathy Giesel, and her staff, Jane Conway. Please come forward and make yourself on the record, and we'll hear your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel. I represent Senate District N in Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for hearing the bill. It is, I realize, a humorous statement to make, but this is a very simple bill. This bill will update 34-year-old nurse practitioner statute titles. The old title for nurse practitioners, if this bill passes, is Advanced Nurse Practitioner, or ANP, and Nurse Anesthetist, or NA. The updated term, which this bill puts into place, is Advanced Practice Registered Nurse, or APRN. I want to be clear from the outset, Mr. Chairman, this bill does not change in any way the scope of practice that Advanced Practice Registered Nurses have. So why are we doing this? Mr. Chairman, first of all, I would, for simplicity, call your attention to a chart that is in your binder, which shows the changes that are going to be made, and I'm going to explain the chart as we go along. There is an organization, the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. I served on that board for a period of time, and during that time, the title for Advanced Practice Registered Nurses was standardized in a document called a consensus model. In other words, all the states agreed to standardize the title. Each state had a different title for Advanced Practice Nurses. So, looking at the chart, I'm going to explain. The top half of the chart shows ANP and NA. That stands for Advanced Nurse Practitioner and Nurse Anesthetist. These are the old terms. Underneath Advanced Nurse Practitioner are three subspecialties, so to speak. There's Nurse Practitioner, Clinical Nurse Midwife, so this is a nurse who delivers babies, does prenatal care, and Clinical Nurse Specialist. A Clinical Nurse Specialist practices in a hospital. The new title is represented in the chart below. So instead of ANP, it's now going to be APRN, and under it fall the four categories. Clinical nurse, certified nurse practitioner, pardon me, certified nurse midwife, certified registered nurse anesthetist, and clinical nurse specialist. So that's all the bill does, is it transforms our statutes to reflect APRN, Advanced Practice Registered Nurse. Part of the reason for this is that there is confusion among insurance companies. Each state has been using a different title, and so when it comes down to reimbursement for insurance companies, Medicare, and even the Veterans Administration, sometimes reimbursements are denied because they don't recognize the credential of the person that provided the service. This will make us in uniform conformity with other states, Mr. Chairman. Right now, there are 1,000 advanced practice registered nurses in Alaska, and so it will affect a large number of clinicians. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions, and I have folks online if you'd like to speak with them.
Questions? Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator. You had mentioned that there will be some reimbursements based on confusion about service provider. Could you give us some examples of those and what the value of those may be?
As a primary care provider, I can bill insurance for my services just like a family practice physician. I am, in this category, an advanced nurse practitioner, or NP. And so if that insurance company does not recognize what ANP, the initials after my name, stand for, they will question what kind of reimbursement I would be entitled to for the care of that patient. And so this way, we're standardizing the letters that will come after my name.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
Yeah, Senator, when we're talking about this, is Alaska behind other states in doing this then? Or other states have moved towards this? Obviously, it must be a national recognition of this.
There are 13 states that have 100% implemented this change in title. There's about 29 states that are working on this right now, us being one of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've been joined by Representative Guerra. Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gaddis.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Giesel. I guess one of the questions that come to mind, and I have never worked within the health industry, but do these, if you will, label changes, is it possible that we have folks working and doing that job right now that with these changes will force, for lack of a better word, the hospitals to pay them at a different rate? Does that make a difference? Will that make a difference from the hospital standpoint? And ultimately, it'll make a difference from what we pay.
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, it will make no difference in the reimbursement or pay for any of these categories of advanced practice nurses. In terms of hospital practice, the clinical or the certified nurse midwife and the certified registered nurse anesthetist are the two categories that would be practicing both in a hospital facility as well as outside. They've been doing that for numerous years if they have hospital privileges. The clinical nurse specialist practices almost exclusively in a hospital. It shouldn't change their pay category at all.
Thank
Follow
you.
Up, Representative Gaddis?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's okay. That's what I was looking for. Thanks.
Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the chart that you've shown us and that you've been working off of, a couple of questions. The first one is anybody, and let's say the NP, the nurse practitioner, if the nurse practitioner becomes called a certified nurse practitioner, and this goes with the others as well that change, is there any difference in certification? Are there anybody that you know or the department knows or the organizations knows that those people will no longer be defined as that, and they will have to do additional training to move up or to conform to the changes?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, excellent question, and the answer is no. Since the advanced nurse practitioners have been recognized in the state of Alaska 34 years, over that time we all have national board certification now required for practice to even get a license in advanced practice. That won't change at all. The same national certifying boards will still administer the same examinations to us and certify us in the same way.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Guttenberg.
Thank you. So in the chart on the top in the current Alaska statutes, you have nurse anesthetist as standalone. but in the proposed statute change, they're on a different organizational chart under advanced practice registered nurse. What is that? What happens to that, and what is the effect on that on those guys? And is this something that group supports or doesn't?
Thank you for the question, Representative Guttenberg. Through the chair, the reason that you see ANP and nurse anesthetist separate on the upper chart is because that's how the statutes were initially written, as they've been written over 30, 34 years ago, over the many years. The new title simply puts everyone under the advanced practice registered nurse title. All four of the categories you see under APRN are part of a coalition that some of the members are actually on the line if you wish to speak to them, and they all are supportive of this change. There is 100% support for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the answer. Sometimes alliances don't always speak out when we would like them to, but thank you for that answer. Thank you.
Further questions of the sponsor by the committee? Seeing none, we're going to have invited testimony concerning House Bill or Senate Bill 53, and we have Carrie Doyle and Laura Sarcone. They're at the Anchorage IO at this time. Ms. Doyle, are you there?
Hello, this is Carrie Doyle. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead and place yourself on the record. Give us your titles, and we'll hear your testimony.
All right, thank you. Well, hello, Mr. Chairman. I am Dr. Carrie Doyle. I am an adult health clinical nurse specialist and represent the Alaska Clinical Nurse Specialists Association. I'm also a member of the Alaska APRN Alliance, which is comprised of all four advanced practice registered nurse specialties, AANA, and the University of Anchorage, Alaska, as well as the Board of Nursing. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify in support of Senate Bill 53, which is an act related to advanced practice registered nursing that will align Alaska statute with the nationwide movement called the consensus model. Currently, as a clinical nurse specialist, I am called a nurse practitioner legally, which is not the role that I perform, and can be confusing to patients. So as noted, there are four different specialties, and that being the nurse practitioner, the clinical nurse specialist, the nurse midwife, and the CRNA, or nurse anesthetist. The statute will separate these categories. As I mentioned, the consensus model is a nationwide movement that includes all four specialties. It was comprised or built by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing in conjunction with an APRN work group that comprised of 48 different national nursing organizations. The consensus model does seek uniformity in APRN licensure, accreditation, certification, and education. Uniformity will expedite insurance reimbursement, as noted by Senator Giesel, and by eliminating confusion about service providers, which in turn eliminates the confusion with our patients. It also allow APRNs from other states to more easily obtain Alaska licensure. Senate Bill 53 does not change the scope of practice for AMPs and nurse anesthetists, who will still be able to continue to provide that same high-quality, safe, accessible care that they have provided to Alaskans across the state for the last 34 years. They will just have a new name, APRN. I thank you for your time today and ask that you support Senate Bill 53.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Also in the LIO in Anchorage, I believe we have Laura Sarcone. Laura, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
I'll go ahead and place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Laura Sarcone. I am a certified nurse midwife, and I am the immediate past co-chair of the APRN Alliance. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of SB 53. The four advanced practice nursing groups have been working together on this issue for nearly 5 years. The APRN consensus model is a national best practice act. It puts consumers, employers, APRNs, the Board of Nursing, insurance companies, and the legislature on the same page. It standardizes licensing, accreditation, certification, and educational requirements for APRNs. As Senator Giesel has already noted, 13 states have fully implemented the consensus model. Another 29 states plus the District of Columbia are more than 50% implemented. There are only 8 states that are less than 50% implemented, and 33 states already use the title APRN. The APRN Alliance has reviewed the fiscal note attached to this bill, and we understand that the $7,500 will be recovered through licensing fees and are not general revenue, not general funds. We would like to thank Senator Giesel for sponsoring this bill and for championing this issue on behalf of her fellow APRNs. I urge you to vote in favor of SB 53. Thank you.
All right. We have a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Ms. Sarcone, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am, Representative Guerra.
Hi. The bill seems straightforward. You mentioned that it took 5 years for the various nursing groups to come together. So I just want to hear what the dispute was, so just in case there are any policy considerations for us.
What I said is that we have been working on this for nearly 5 years. It did not take us 5 years to come together on it. We have been together for the full 5 years. It has taken that long for us to work through the Board of Nursing, work through the logistics of getting language together, requesting Senator Giesel to get the bill through Ledge Legal, et cetera.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Now I understand.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Further questions so far? If not, we're going to move on to Gail Burns, Executive Director of the Board of Nursing, and she's off net. Gail, are you there?
Hi, good afternoon. This is Gail Behrens. I'm the Executive Administrator for the Board of Nursing. Thank you for hearing this bill and for permitting me to address this hearing. The Board of Nursing has requested that I voice their support of this bill to update our regulations. This will help to bring Alaska into compliance with the national consensus model developed by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. I thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. I see no questions. Next, we're going to move to Tracy Weiss, Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Alliance. Tracy, are you online?
I am, yes.
Place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
So my name is Dr. Tracy Weiss. I'm both a family and psychiatric nurse practitioner. Thank you for letting everybody talk. Really, I'm just here to answer questions representing the current, I'm the current co-chair of the APRN Alliance, as well as the immediate past president and legislative chair of the Alaska Nurse Practitioners Association. And both groups are here to voice their support and urge you to pass this bill today. Thank you.
Questions of Ms. Logan? No, Ms. Weiss. I don't see any at this time. Also online, we have Chris Logan, who is a nurse anesthetist. She is online to answer any questions if anybody has them. Okay. Does the committee have any further questions or discussions? Any further questions of the sponsor? Representative Newman. Okay.
Going through the list and looking at things and questions pop up.
Thank you, Senator. Senator, I was going through your sectional analysis and came across several questions I'd like to ask. In Section 10, it adds a paragraph requiring Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to set fees related to practice registered nursing and deletes vocational nursing. Why would we do that?
We would remove the word vocational because that term is no longer used. In fact, it was removed from most of our statutes with a piece of legislation about 5 years ago. This was a spot that was missed.
Representative Newman.
So it's basically conforming language.
You are correct.
And in Section 13, amends Alaska statute to add advanced practice registered nurses to the persons authorized to supervise a practical nurse. I don't know what the qualifications are currently, but, you know, I think what when I'm reading through the sections and what, it, you know, you introduced this as a simple bill that's just basically changing the name, but it seems to do more things than that. It provides for more services or duties that nurses can do. Again, authorized to supervise a practical nurse. Could you explain what that does and why?
Absolutely. Representative Newman, through the chair. If you read the full sentence, a practical nurse, this is a, just for clarity here, a practical nurse is typically a two-year degree, shall work under the supervision of a licensed registered nurse. If you take out the underlined words, that's what the statute previously said, under a licensed registered nurse. Registered nurse is a higher level licensure. This qualifies the RN to supervise an LPN. An advanced practice registered nurse is at minimum a master's degree. Most of the education now is moving to a doctoral degree. So this simply adds, for clarity, the doctorally prepared nurse who also would supervise the licensed practical nurse.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, under sections 52 through 54, you state that APRNs to practitioners who may, under statutory provisions concerning mental health commitment, determine if a person may be administered psychotropic medication without the person's consent. In other issues that we've dealt with in the medical industry, doctors are pretty sensitive to the ability to administer different prescription drugs because of the amount of education that they've received on that, particularly with the use of psychotropic drugs. I'm not understanding why this is needed. This seems to advance your authority quite a bit.
You, for clarity, Representative Newman, through the chair, you said sections 52 through 54. Please help me with that.
I'm just going through your sectional analysis.
Understood. Was it, I don't have it in front, sectional?
Yes, section 52 through 54.
Okay, so let's start with section 52. Okay. Again, the underlined words, as you know, are the ones that are being changed. So here the phrase is as determined by a licensed physician or a registered nurse. Again, emphasizing a registered nurse is either a 2 or 4 year degree, that's a bachelor's. An advanced practice registered nurse, however, is a master's or doctorally prepared. So as the statute was previously written, an advanced practice registered nurse could, in fact, as determined by a licensed physician or registered nurse, do this. This simply clarifies by inserting advanced practice registered nurse as well. A higher level registered nurse who has prescriptive authority. A registered nurse does not. So that's section 52. Moving on to section 53. Let's see. This has to do with the definition of a mental health professional. Okay. So the original language, this is listing the definition of a mental health professional, and it used to say a registered nurse with a master's degree in psychiatric nursing. That is the definition of an advanced practice registered nurse. Now, it is possible for an RN to have an advanced degree, a master's degree in psychiatric nursing, but not be an advanced practice nurse. This clarifies that a master's or doctorally prepared nurse could also be categorized as a mental health professional. You heard from Dr. Tracy Weiss. She is a doctorally prepared mental health professional. So she falls under this definition. It does not extend or expand their scope of practice. Let's see. Then we're in section 54, and it's on page 25. The original language said, on line 5, reviewed by a registered nurse licensed under blah, blah, blah. This is reviewing a residence-assisted living plan. And so as an advanced practice registered nurse, I am also a registered nurse, okay, so we advanced practice hold two licenses. We pay twice to the state of Alaska, RN and advanced practice. So this simply clarifies that as an RN I could already do this, but additionally an advanced practice registered nurse can also do it. It's clarifying language.
Hello. Representative Newman.
Thank you. So, Senator, I'm assuming then that an advanced practical nurse would have to have specific training to administer psychotropic medication?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, a nurse practitioner is educated either at a master's or doctoral degree and are currently statutorily authorized to prescribe. In fact, with DEA, Drug Enforcement Authority, we also prescribe controlled substances should we decide to apply for that DEA authorization. We have full prescriptive authority, just like a family practice or other type of physician.
One more.
Representative Newman.
Thank you for allowing me to ask the questions, Mr. Chair. Senator, when I look at this, and we had, obviously we're looking at the budget under some of the nurses perform some of the clinical work in villages where we have just nurses. To me, this seems like, in some of the health centers, this seems like it would have more opportunities within the state of Alaska. Is that part of the reason you're doing this too? Because I'm trying to fit this together, how, you know, we continue to have to try and reduce the budget as we are, but make sure we have medical services around Alaska. It seems to me that this would be an opportunity for Alaska to expand that.
Representative Nguyen, you are, through the chair, you are speaking to my heart, and I will clarify once again, this bill does not change anything that doesn't currently exist. In fact, many advanced practice registered nurses practice in rural areas where there is no other health care, not even an Indian Health Service type clinic. One of the provisions in another bill that will come before this committee, having to do with Medicaid, will allow particularly mental health and behavioral health nurse practitioners to expand their ability to practice, as well as other mental health providers, doing exactly what you're advocating. Thank you for the question. But this bill itself does not expand what we as advanced practice registered nurses can already do in rural Alaska or any other venue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Okay, is there any further questions from committee members? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, a question does come up. Senator Giesel, I probably should know this, and forgive me if I don't, but does this change envision this bill change the membership of the Board of Nursing such that it's going to affect the permit or the professional licensing fee?
Very nice question, Senate Representative Sadler. Through the chair, there is currently a seat on the Board of Nursing for an advanced practice registered nurse, so it will make absolutely no changes.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
Okay, now my question was more lines of, is this going to change which professional board will regulate APRNs? And will that change the universe of license fee payers and therefore the rate required of each?
Again, thank you, Representative Sadler. Through the chair, it will not make any changes. Right now, advanced practice registered nurses are nurses. They fall under the Board of Nursing. In fact, the Board of Nursing regulates about 12,000 licensees, from certified nurse aides all the way up to a doctorally prepared advanced practice nurse.
Okay. Also in the room, we do have Director Janie Heventon, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, to answer any questions that anybody might have. Is there further questions of the Senator? Seeing none, I appreciate very much your presentation today. You have any closing comments?
Only thank you very much for hearing the bill, Mr. Chairman, and I hope you do see this as a simple bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this time, we're going to put Senate Bill 53 aside and prepare for presentation on House Bill 268. We'll be brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Next we have House Bill 268, ADA, Dividend to the State, Income and Valuation, sponsored by Rules at the request of the Governor, and here to present House Bill 268 from the Alaska Energy Authority are Gene Theriau and Michael Lamb. Please come place yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Gene Theriau with ADA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael Lamb with ADA.
And, Mr. Chairman, to move forward, I would like to start the presentation by making references to the bill. Mr. Lamb will, who is the Chief Financial Officer for ADA, will actually walk you through the PowerPoint presentation. After I do my section, I am going to need to slip away. We've got another bill up downstairs. If the members could look to the actual copy of the legislation and turn to page 2, I'd like to just talk about the existing statutory language that was implemented in 1996, requiring that ADA pay a dividend to the state of Alaska. Shortly after that section of statute, those sections of statute were added to the legislation, the legislature realized that there were certain things that that happened as the enterprise achieved or received their audited financial statement on a yearly basis. Adjustments were made to net income in order to receive that audited financial statement. But there were certain things that it made sense then to back out, to get closer or get back to a true picture of the net income for the year before the dividend was calculated for the state of Alaska, so that the dividend would actually be calculated on income that was received by the state of Alaska, by ADA. And so if you look on page 2 on line 3, at the end of the line there, it says excluding. And then also down below on page 2, line 21, the word excluding appears in existing statute. And that, again, was a recognition of the legislature that while you had to do certain things to get that audited financial statement, before you calculated the dividend, we wanted you to go in, back out certain adjustments that you have to do for accounting purposes to get to true net income before you calculate the dividend to the state. So you can see the main language being suggested for being added to the statute here is after the word excluding, we're expanding the language there to include a couple of new accounting rules and other problems that we've identified that are bringing unnecessary volatility to the calculation of the ADA dividend. And there are two problems that we're trying to fix with this legislation. The first is a mark-to-market adjustments that have to be made in order to get the financial audited statement. And then also in instances where ADA is tasked with looking at a project and given an outside source of money, so that could be an appropriation from the state or receipt of federal funds to look at a particular project. Previously, the legislature instructed ADA to disregard those receipts when they came in because there was no need if the legislature gave ADA $1,000 to look at a project. They didn't expect ADA then to turn around and give half the money back in the calculation of dividend. They said, no, we want you to do the project, and so please don't take into consideration that appropriation of grant funds when you run your calculation for dividend on income. So we're trying to fix that problem when any a project has a component that gets written off, and then also exclude those mark-to-market adjustments. And if you'll look at the language on page 2, starting on line 5, you can see that losses on a project or development to the extent that project was financed with a state or federal grant. So it was money that came to the ADA, not from their revenue stream, but came from an outside source. Those are to be disregarded. And then on line 7, the mark-to-market adjustments that are done for accounting purposes are to be excluded. So the presentation that Mr. Lamb has, I've come by and appreciated the time with each of you or a member of your staff to walk through an abbreviated version of this slide presentation. As Mr. Lamb goes through it, I think he's got some examples that will really help you understand the impact of the adjustments that need to be made in order to get our audited financial statement, and why it makes sense that we would back those out, get back to true net income, and that would be the number that we would use for calculation of the aided dividend. So with that, I'm available for questions before I step away.
Yes, maybe you or during the presentation, Mr. Lamb might have the answer to this, but looking at the bill on page 2, line 8, and also on page 2, line 26, it removes the reference to AS 4488172, which is the economic development account. How does the omission of this account affect the dividend?
Mr. Chair, there's actually two. There's 155 and 172. And 172 is the projects. And so to some extent, it doesn't really have an effect. We just took it out. And some of the language changes are in here are ones that went through, sorry if I get this wrong, legal. For clarification and stuff. And so by fixing the language up front before that, where it says basically that if there's any financing that is for a project that came from the state or the feds, it comes out. So the 172, part of the problem with 172, it only picks part of the projects that ADA actually does. And so in the presentation, I think somewhere in there I'll say under the right set of circumstances, which means if it's a 172 project, it would have an effect the way it is right now, but under a 155 project, that language doesn't apply. And so we're basically trying to clean it up, take 172 out and 155. So under either case or type of a project, even if it was a 155 project, if the money came from the state or came from the feds, then it would not affect the dividend. And I think the example, Mr. Chair, will hopefully make that clear.
And yeah, there's quite a few projects that are under 172, so I was wondering. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Chairman, in addition, back when that exclusion was first added to the statute, I believe 172 was in existence, but the SETS funds and other funds didn't exist at that time. So it was very specific that it said that federal grants or outside grants that came into that fund were to be excluded. By removing that language, that exclusion will apply to not only the 172, but the other funds that have been created since that time.
Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Brief question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Terry, help me understand. I think I understand what mark-to-market fair value means, but can you help me understand the origin of the term? What's the mark implied? Just to help me understand the term better.
That during your presentation, you'll explain that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Working backwards, so you know what market is, right? So mark would be like be adjusting or basically adjusting to market so that you mark the value of an asset. So if you held a stock that was worth, you know, on your books, you paid $1,000 for it. A year goes by and it's worth $1,100. So you're basically marking up, adjusting the value of that original $1,000 to $1,100. So I can't tell you where all these terms come from, mark to market, but it basically means that you're adjusting that number to the market value number.
Thank you. I had understood it to mean from this to that, from mark to the market, but you're just saying ascertain it according to, in reference to the market. That makes sense.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the mark to market would be book value that's on the financial statements to what the market says it's worth as of a point in time, and thus you have these entries.
Thank you.
Okay, continue with your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lamb's going to take it away now with the presentation, going through the slide presentation, and I'm going to excuse myself to go to House Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, and I know it's kind of bad form, actually, to apologize about a presentation before you ever get into it, but the reality of it is this is about accounting. There's no way around it and what the terms mean. I'm not going to say this is a simple legislation, but it's not overly complicated. If you're an accountant, you go, oh, okay, but I realize that's not the case. And so as best I could, try to develop these analogies, which I think some of you have seen, try to explain it because I want you to understand what you're voting on and the cause and effect of it. And now that I've apologized. And the other thing, Mr. Chair, is time. I do how much time?
We've got an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
We were hoping you wouldn't take it all.
I'll do my best. And in if I may, and certainly I'm here as a guest, if I actually could get through the presentation maybe, questions that come up may actually get answered during that process, which would probably be perhaps more efficient for your time. But
thank you. We will.
If you would. So with that, Mr. Chair, this slide basically is just to talk about what I'm here to talk about, the history, the goal of this, the statutory language, and as Mr. Chair said, there's really basically two accounting problems that result from the existing language that we want to fix. And I wanted to clarify, too, and to some extent, Ms. Cherio spoke to it, but I'll speak even more directly. And somewhere in here, I used the language to modernize. When the language that was put in and as it has been amended through time is perfectly good and was good, but what's happened is that accounting authoritative guidance has changed. And thus, the impacts of what the original language was now has different consequences without adjusting it. And so that really gets to be the essence of why we're here, is to fix those two things. So historically, this is a quick overview. The dividend process, if you're not familiar with it, really covers the three-year period. There is the year of operations, what happened. The first year is 1995. The second column there is the payable, and in the middle is would be fiscal year 96. So you have whatever the activity is in 1995, the fiscal year is over, so 6/30/95 is done. Close the books, you go through the audit process, you're in fiscal year 96. Somewhere around December-ish of each year, a recommendation is made to the board by the staff, based upon the audited results, and say it's our recommendation that this dividend be declared by the board, which then becomes payable, so you actually write the checks out in that third year. So the history of it is the first year of activity is 95, 96 the audit, the first payment is $15 million, and then you can see at the bottom, for this schedule, and ideally this schedule keeps going out into the future and more dividends are paid by ADA and received. But there's been about $380 million in dividends that have been declared. There's the questions always comes up, what was the original capitalization, the revolving fund, which you can see there were two components here, about 189 and 4. So about $332 million was the original capitalization. So, you know, there's time value, but in essence, the money that was made available has been repaid back and through the dividends, and ideally, that keeps on going perpetually for some time into the future. So, all right. The goal and the reason for the language changes is really to share with the state through the annual dividend the benefits of the operations of ADA's results. The other color blue right in the middle there is really the essence, is to bring some stability and predictability to what that dividend is. And in fact, the first year that I went from the Fairbanks North Star Borough as a CFO and went to ADA, there was a huge swing in the net income, which means there was a huge swing in the dividend, and the board said, we're going to need an explanation to tell legislators of why our dividend dropped so much. I go, well, it's really easy. The unrealized losses reduce the net income. That's easier said than understood. So that really gets to be the stability and predictability in fixing it is partly driven by just not having to deal with that question. And again, This is truly just, it's an accounting issue, and as I say here, we're really trying to modernize the statutory language, bringing it forth to say we should evolve the language just as the Government Accounting Standards Board has evolved the authoritative guidance. And in the simplest terms, there's really three types of transactions. Only the third one is really a problem that we're addressing here. And the first one, I just label those real transactions. That's like you actually earn real revenues, you write real checks, you go buy real equipment, that kind of stuff. That's no big deal. The second one, anybody that owns a business is familiar with estimates and allocations, i.e. you have to depreciate your equipment that you bought, you amortize intangibles, et cetera, et cetera. The third one, which is these market value adjustments, these are entries related to transactions that don't occur but are required to book and adjust the records. So ADA, to be in compliance with the statute, actually has to have an audit, and in order to comply with the audit, they have to be GAAP-based, general accepted accounting principles, which means in the government setting, you have to follow the Government Accounting Standards Board, which is the highest authoritative body. And I put in red that we want to modernize, again, the existing, and as Mr. Terrio talked about, just that exclusion language to do a little bit of cleanup there. So this whole discussion is really about not too many words, but that's the essence of it. So the pertinent language, this is me, and I don't have the whole thing, but this is part of what you were just looking at. And when the authority shall adopt a policy to pay dividend, not less than 25, more than 25% of the net income. And it's this last section here, the language that sort of drives why we're here, is that net income, which we always refer to that as a statutorily defined net income, because that's what it is, means net change in position or the equivalent. And for those of us that are older, had business used to call results of operations, you could call it net income. All those things, they're the same label for what's the difference between revenues and expenses, right? But that statutory net income has to be GAAP-based, and that net income number is the result of the audited financials. So you have to do an audit, which means you have to follow authoritative guidance. And then, as Mr. Terrio pointed out, then you have excluding, et cetera, right? So this is the driver why we need to fix the language. What I tried to do was to create sort of a visual a stack of how you get to the dividend. And so the dividend's at the very top, and the based on the statutorily defined net income is exactly what we're just talking about right here, the net income. That's that exact language. Calculated, and the next thing is, so you have to get to the point, you have a GAAP-based audited financial statement that the board has accepted. In order to get to that, those financial statements have to have, and here's the two problems we're talking about, the market value and or write-down or loss entries as required by GAAP, and GAAP requires GASB. So you work your way up to get to the audited numbers. So visually in this process, you can see here that once you have that audited financial statement and then that language that deals with excluding, HB 268 is, I'm afraid to use the word, I won't use the word, well, if I say simplifying, I'm using it, right? 268 is just modifying the current excluded language from the audit results so that statutory defined net income would then not include any market value and or state or federally funded write-down activity when calculating dividend. That is where this language gets inserted into the process to doing the dividend. And then ultimately, once you have that statutory defined net income, then the board is presented a recommendation by the staff, 25 to 50% of what that statutory net income number is, dividends declared, and then our chart continues in perpetuity and pay money. So that's where the change that is being proposed and recommended has an effect. So a little bit more discussion, the market value. The problem really gets to be, as we've talked about, general accepted accounting principle keeps evolving, and now we have these market value entries. And you actually see in one of the slides where they started. And the result of the market value entries is ADA's net income swings. If the income swings and the dividend is a percentage of that income number, then obviously the dividend ends up swinging. And we want to fix that. And ultimately, the other thing that's kind of important about this, and I think the analogy hopefully will drive this point too, is that the dividend, in the end, it's a cash-based payment. We're actually writing a check, and it's pathetically bad form to have a check bounce. So the timing of when you write the check and the availability of cash to write that check matters. So this is my the best analogy I could come up with to talk about the market value, the entries, and what the impacts of it are. And so here, this is the actual a very good copy of the 2015 1040. Everybody here will be using. And the reason this is a good analogy is that you and I are all, whether you ever use the term or not, are cash-based taxpayers, right? We as individuals don't do accrual like businesses do, but we're cash-based. And so whatever that cash-based final net income, you have your revenues, take whatever deductions, credits you get, you have some number, you take that net number, you apply it to the federal government's tax tables, right, and then you're supposed to pay them that amount. Likewise, ADA goes through a process, comes up with a net income number, and then goes to the board, and the board applies essentially a tax rate, a dividend rate of 25 to 50%. So they're exactly sort of the same process. So what I did to try to demonstrate this, I'm just going to grab this net income section, and I'm going to stick it up here, and I did a quick and dirty example that, let's just assume under line 7, if you get your W-2, you just $100,000 in net income to make it easy. Under lines 8 and 9, which is interest and dividend, so I just presume you have a brokerage account, whether it's at Schwab or E-Trade or wherever it's at, you have about $250,000 in there, and you earn 3% on the $250,000 in the form of interest and dividend, and you actually got it. And so you have about another $7,500 that you would have to stick up there. Then down on line 21, I just said the permanent funds, they got it for $1,500. So in your tax return, you would be $109,000, and then you go back and go, do you have any standard deductions or exemptions? But that's your revenue number. Everything else beyond that doesn't change. Now, suppose that you, as an individual, had to apply these GASB statements standards, which are mark-to-market fair value adjustments. So there's 31, 68, 72, and 75. And the only one, and you'll see a little bit in a chart that has been in place, is 31. And part of the reason for bringing this forward is not only the volatility that 31 has done, but I think it's fair and accurate to suggest and say that there's going to be a compounding effect of these things, which would make the volatility even greater. GASB 68 has to do with recording the unfunded obligation related to pensions, right? And if you know, the pension unfunded obligation has two sides to the balance sheet. There's the asset side, and then there's the liability side from the actuary. Well, a lot of the asset side are all investments, marketable securities. And so GASB 31 will actually drive the gain and loss on those retirement funds, right, which will then end up, and we'll have that, and then that number will end up following through to the income statement of all the local entities, which will be ours too. And so some of these will have a compounding effect. So if you took those four and you said, okay, they are all applicable to you and I as taxpayers, and the federal government says, well, you have had a change in your wealth, which is really what we're talking about here, and we want you to be treated the same way. So my example here Now, if I take this 1040 example and I say, okay, let's personalize that, the first thing, GASB 31, which is the marketable securities, all of us, if we had a portfolio that we didn't buy or sell anything from 12/31/14, and it had some value, and at 12/31/15, right, we got our statement, and it was worth $25,000 more because the market value had increased. And we did the exact same thing that ADA does in getting to an audited financial statement. We would have to stick a $25,000 worth of gain because the IRS would say, you have to act like you sold that at end of the business day at 12/31, and you record the fact that you actually had an increase in wealth. So it's an unrealized increase in wealth, but if you had actually sold it, you would have to record it. So you stick the $25,000 up there. Then GASB 68, which actually has to do with the pension side of the PERS component, and I said, well, most of us have an IRA, we have a 401k, and in this instance, I said, just assume that your retirement account, your individual retirement accounts, and I'm sorry, I'm on slide 13. Retirement accounts were worth about $200,000, and they increased, just like your normal brokerage account, went up about $10,000. So I said, just assume about a 5% increase over a year, which is reasonable. So you didn't actually take any money, you didn't get it, but it's worth more. So I'm going to have you recognize that adjustment. I'm going to the market value. There's $10,000 you add in there. Then GASB 72, which is a fair value adjustment, which comes into effect year ending 6/30/16. So that one comes into effect now. I said, well, maybe a good analogy there is you have a rental property. Maybe it's worth $400,000. Guess what? Real estate values went up over the year. I put just 5% in there. So there's $20,000. And then the one that's the most difficult, and GASB 75 is not, it's not in effect yet, but it comes into effect, I think, for years ending 6/30/18. That's the OPEB side of the PERS and TERS question, right? Your health care, your disability, those types of things, right? So I just put $5,000. So all of a sudden, your $109,000 of taxable income that you would then flip over to the next page and start putting in your exemptions or standard deductions or credits, I mean, it doesn't matter, your revenue number is now $60,000 higher, right? And what I put at the bottom of this is that these adjustments, as you'll see in the real example with ADA and GASB 31, they can go in any direction. But I tried to make this a straightforward, simple example. So what happens then, HB 268's, what would be the impact on that 1040? And the short of changing the exclusion language or actually modifying the excluding language is that from ADA's perspective, you would go through and you would do the audit, but then when you have that audited financial statement, and then when you're going to what is the statutory defined net income, you would take out all of those market value adjustments, right? So your 169,000 audited number, when you do the dividend, is back down to 109. That's the essential impact of the language on those last couple of lines. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So this is the real effect on ADA. This is a quarter of a century. This is 25 years of net income, audited numbers put in a line chart from 91 to 15. When you lay on top of this, what happens to that net income number, and you can see it swings. Probably if you look at 2004, there's the biggest swing, went from 03 to 04, went from maybe $35 million decreased down to $25 million. And you can see another year. So each of those points is really the year end. They're just connected with a line, right? Now, here's what happens when this is what the actual audited financial statement for ADA looks like when you laid GASB 31. So we basically just took our audited financial numbers, backed out GASB 31, then realized gains and losses to come up with the green. But you can see when GASB 31 came into play, which was in 97, and then you can see how much volatility it does to that net income number, which drives the statutory number. So when you look at this and what is the impact, essentially all of these areas that are above where the green line is at and all of those points, which are really the net income number, all of those areas up above are where that analogy is such a good example for any one particular year, that what you actually earned, which would have been in the blue font on my example, right, the 109, all of a sudden turns into 169. And so you're having, or ADA is having, or has had to calculate a dividend based upon where the gold line has gone to. So all those areas above is where ADA, this gets to be an issue. I said that you really, as is the reason that most of us are cash-based taxpayers, that as cash-based taxpayers, whatever that tax bill is, in theory, you had the cash to pay those taxes, right? That's why you don't recognize or do accrual and personal. Same thing here. All those areas above are areas where, like in 2010, you can see the net income was about 40, maybe 41 million, something like that. With the effect of GASB 31, it went almost to about $58 million. You know, this huge chunk, and you apply 50% or so dividend to that, you're writing a check out where you actually didn't get that money in the bank, but you got to write the check for it. So the flip of the upside is this one is the downside. In these instances, this is where the effect of GASB 31 made the dividend, the statutory net income number, actually lower. 13 is a great year to look at because the audited net income before the impact of GASB 31 was about 44 million dollars. The mark-to-market effect of acting as though we sold all of our investments at 6/30, even though we didn't, you have to make that entry, put the net income down to just a little bit above $20 million. That's a huge impact. Then you apply the percentage to it, and all of a sudden, this is an example where ADA actually had earned real money per the green line, was able to write a larger check, but the check was less because of the way that the financial statements are and the impact of GASB 31. And now, again, looking out into the future, if you stacked 68 on top of that and 72 and 75 at some point, that line's going to become even more volatile. Simple?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So problem number two is the dividend penalty. And it's somewhat, Mr. Chair, gets to your question a little bit, but hopefully this will make sense, that the dividend penalty is, and that's the term actually that I phrase because I think it's what it is. And Mr. Chair will talk a little bit about this. If ADA is given money from the state or the feds for a project, so you get the cash and you convert the cash into CWIP, so you're building an asset, right? And then for whatever reason, it's like, okay, we're not going to move forward with that. You have to take and write that asset off of the books, right? You can't report an asset on your financial statements that really doesn't have the value. So the way that you get that off of the books is you reduce the WIP, the asset, and it has to flow through the income statement as an expense, basically. As a write-down. The effect of that, of course, then you have less income. And so why I say there's a dividend penalty, it could be 25 to 50%, and that's one of the things that we want to end up fixing too. So I have the same example displayed two different ways, so hopefully one of them will make a sense. Again, seems like accounting, it's, I never know when somebody goes, oh, I got it, and if this is more than you needed, I'm sorry about that, and if it's not enough, I'm sorry about it. Hopefully it's about right. But so this example, this is a Project X, this is a hypothetical. This actually is a, under the current language, this would be like a 155 project, but it's part of ADA's revolving fund, therefore it rolls up in the revolving fund. And so this actually, part of the schedule, the computation statutory income for fiscal year 17 dividend comes out of the very back of the audit. It's schedule number 7. In this instance, and if you remember, went back to those charts, it was up just about $28 million. Then you make adjustments for the current language, and you're down to 25.5. If this were a year, and this is not frequent. I mean, so this is not, it is not consistent like the GASB 31, which is every single year. GASB 68 is every single year. This is under the right circumstances. But when we were talking about we really should fix the statutes, we were like, we should just sort of fix this too. At least we should bring it forward and say, we think you should fix this, and this is why, and then whatever happens, happens. But assume now, again, in our Project X, that we had 25, and all of a sudden the controller and I go, well, the circumstances are such that the legislature or the federal government said, we're not going to put any more money into this. It really has no future value. We have to write it down. All of a sudden our $25.3 million of net income, deduct 8.8, and you're down to 16.5. That would be our audited net income number. And at a 50% dividend, that net income number is lower. That's $4.4 million that the dividend would be reduced by. So let's just assume, I'll give you two examples. Let's just say the federal government had paid, had given the 8.8 to ADA, had gone through, we wrote it off. The state would actually be out $4.4 million of the dividend because of the way that the statutes are right now. That doesn't exclude this, right? Likewise, so you're getting penalized, right, for a project that was funded with state, with federal dollars. ADA got it, followed GAAP, reported it, said, okay, there's no value, you write it down, the dividend's reduced. The other alternative is, suppose the state had put the $8.8 million in, said, ADA, we want you to go do this. Here's our direction. We appropriated it, go do this, and then it's like, okay, we're not going to move forward. So same effect, you still write it down, but in that instance, the state would have written a check for $8.8 million to fund the project at first, right? And then when ADA's financial statements are done, that 8.8 comes out, reduces the net income, the dividend gets reduced. And so what seemed like a good idea, which otherwise he wouldn't have done it, was 8.8, but all of a sudden that 8.8 project really cost you $13.2 million in cash. Does that make sense? That's why I call it a dividend penalty, because the 8.8 you're not getting anything for, that's out the door, and the dividend is reduced just because of following the reporting criteria. And that's the one language that says by excluding projects or write-downs that were financed with federal or state money, it would take, you wouldn't show that in this calculation. So this is one way to look at it. The other way is take this. This is the same exact bar I showed you, the lines for GASB 31. And if I just took that very section of it and I blew it up over here, and if you look at the very ends, and the green line is about that $28 million I just showed you in that schedule, right? I said Schedule 7 started with 27. It was like $28 million. And then you do the adjustments, and you're down to where, and throw the audit number in there, so it's the yellow. But if you put the 8.8, then the net income number is down to that 16.6. This is just a visual of how would those lines look different if you had that 8.8 added to the net income number. And really, this section just really where it says the unrealized losses, loss, that area just changes, and all of a sudden there's your 8.8 because you went from the 25-ish down to the about 16-ish. There's your 8.8, and you go, okay, you're done, you have your net income, statutorily defined, and if you applied 50% to that 8.8, that's $4.4 million smaller dividend. So doesn't happen very frequently, but could it happen? It could happen, and so it's like we should just try to fix it. So the proposed statutory language and explanation, so this, I try to stick up here, so 2 has the market value, you know, that's added, but in essence, the real guts of it is what I put in the orangish color. Net income means the change in net position. We talked about it has to be under GAAP, as set out in the audit, right, so you have to have it audited. And then you get to excluding amounts attributable to intergovernmental transfers, capital contributions, grants. And then you see losses on a project or development to the extent financed with state or federal grants or appropriations. So that is the language that fixes problem number 2 that we talked about. And then when you go on to the mark-to-market fair value-based accounting entries and non-cash accounting entries related to retirement obligations, that fixes the impact of GASB 31, GASB 68, whatever 72 is going to do, and whatever 75 will do. And really, we tried to write the language broad enough that anything that could come, whatever GASB, just Montgomery County Standard Board, decides they want to adjust to, if it's market value, that it would sort of should take care and fix that. That's why the market, the mark to market is as broad as it is, that it could pick up any of those things and get us back to the point, as Mr. Terrio said, and as my analogy says, is like we should pay on the 109, not on the 169 or whatever that number turns out to be. So in the end, the statutory changes to 268 just removes the market value, and the result of that is I think it better stabilizes the dividend, which you just have to compare the green line from the gold line and that volatility. It removes the dividend penalty should the circumstances come around that would create that entry and have that impact. And then finally, it really, this is not to say that sometimes legislative language and ordinances, you have unintended consequences that it's like, oh, we didn't think about that. This is not one of these at all. This is simply trying to modernize the old language to the fact that the reporting requirements under a GAAP base where you get an auditor willing to opine, it's evolved and it's changed. And I think there's going to be a compounding effect, and so that's kind of what this does. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Okay, we're down to questions. Representative Wilson's first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understand that this is a different way of keeping the books. So for your bond rating and credit rating and that type of thing, does changing from one type to another have any effect on that?
No, because the audited financials will still be the audited financials. It's if you... To get to the statutory defined net income, you have to get to the audit. Auditors always go to look at the financials. Sorry, the rating agencies always look at the financials. And I, as you know from being at the borough, I've 12 or 18 bond sales, a lot of rating agencies. They're very smart people, and they understand financials and the accounting, and they can look at them, and they can make adjustments for those types of adjustments. And so the short of it is this has no effect on any of that because you still have to get an audited financial statement done. It's just that the statutory defined net income or used for the dividend is post that audited number. The statutory net income number, to my knowledge, so that's a caveat, isn't used for anything else other than the calculation of the dividend. Trying to essentially take what gets you to an audited number and go, it's just like you add back in, as Ms. Terrio talked about, in that $114 million. Those are appropriations from the state. If you paid a dividend on that, that's like the state giving ADA money and then ADA writing a check back for the dividend. Why would you do that? That doesn't make sense. So you've already sort of fixed some of those things. Mr. Representative Sadler. Sorry.
That's okay.
That was through the chair, by the way, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Lance.
And just a quick follow-up. So it won't affect our bond rating at all?
No, ma'am.
Thank you.
And actually, if I may, we should take a chance to brag while we have time, right? The ADA actually just got done through a update from Standard & Poor's, which I got on March 3rd, and our AA-plus rating was reaffirmed.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Got a couple quick questions. Are there any other state corporations that pay dividends based on the same calculation that ADA? I mean, my question is, should we expect to see the same kind of language come forward for HFC and the railroad and any other AEA maybe?
I have absolutely no knowledge of how their dividends are calculated or what they're based on. And quite frankly, the truth is, well, everything I've said has been true. But it took me a year or two to understand the ramifications of the current language. Every year when the controller and I, we have to sign a letter of representation, letter the former mayor used to have to sign those for on behalf of the city of Fairbanks, right, saying you've done this, this, and this. And it takes a while to understand the cause and effect of the accounting records and then, you know, the ordinances or city codes or whatever you have. And so, you know, and having these conversations about the projects and all the stuff that we do, because, you know, I'm still a licensed registered CPA. I have my other designations, and, you know, that's my livelihood, and I'm not going to compromise that. And, you know, Av, you have these conversations, and you look at the statutes, and you go, geez, you know, we think we should fix it. The obvious glaring thing are the swings in the dividend. But then it's like, well, these other things could happen too. Well, why don't we bring it forth and say, at least we're doing what we think is the right thing to do, to say this should really be fixed. But to your answer, I no idea, Representative Sadler.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler has another question.
Thank you, and two more actually, and this they'll be pretty simple. Is there any relationship between this accounting change and the governor's executive order considering consolidation or efficiencies between ADA, HFC, and AEA?
No, I mean,
through the chair, Representative Sadler.
Sorry, through the chair. Thank you so much. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. I don't believe so. This is, as you know, this was brought up, you know, by us, right, probably July-ish of 2015 as we were preparing for, we're going through the audit. And then the legislative recommendations for statutory changes due to the administration by usually September-ish, something like that. So this, and I have no idea how the world's going to unfold in the future. All I know is what I've presented to you as it is right now, and we'll be at the end of 2016 soon, and we'll have the same circumstance, that we'll do the audit and then we'll look at the exclusions, and this will be what the dividend is.
Okay. And last question, sir.
Very
prosaic. Can you tell me, sir, what the current balance is of the SETS fund, the revolving fund, and the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund?
Through the chair.
Nice.
Representative Sadler.
Maybe not related question to.
Well,
I think the Arctic has like $0, and I think there's been no funding ever put into it. It was put on, the statute put on place. The SETS isn't very much, actually. The money that's really available is really more directed to the IEP, if you will. So I don't think there's anything there. And then in the revolving fund, you asked, tell me what your... I want to make sure you try to give you the approximate right number.
Yep, just shoot the balance.
ADA's net assets in total for the revolving fund, I think, are about 1.2-ish something billion dollars.
We can get that information and get it.
Yes, yes.
All right. You're welcome. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael, for being here. Can you, just along the same lines, to answer, or if you can find out how many other ADA projects, ADA development projects are currently existing that would be impacted by this law change, or if you know the answer to that.
actually, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, this has like zero impact on those, because in the end, for the simplest way to look at it is ADA really kind of has three main revenue sources. It has its loan participation and loans, direct loans, right? It has the return for the projects, which I think there's around eight or so when you add them up. And then ADA has some its own externally basically managed investments that we use to stabilize our cash, you know, and actually it's a big deal with the rating agencies that for geo bonds and stuff. And so this itself will have no impact on the projects, but it could actually have an impact in the other direction, that the project, if let me pick an easy one, DMVA, which is where ADA, you know, the Coast Guard was thinking about leaving Anchorage and stuff because they didn't have a place. And so ADA ended up building a facility on J-Bear for the Coast Guard for 30 years. If for some reason, so that's sitting on our books at, let me just say $13 million. So if for some reason that were to go away, there would be an example of that project. If you just said, or the feds did eminent domain and gave us $5 million for it, right? Then we have an $8 million difference between our book value and what we got. That would flow right down to the income statement, would have an effect on the net income, then would have an effect on the dividend. So I think to your question, this has got nothing going towards the projects, but the projects could have an effect on the result of this as a consequence of the language. Is that
Crystal? Right. I got one more question.
Andy Kawasaki.
Thanks. And when we're talking about writing down assets off the books for like a project that's not moving forward, like I know Susitna wasn't yours, it was AEA's, but how are those entries? Would that be an entry that gets, I mean, of your graph gets taken out then in that point?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. For ADA's books, and that's a term of art, if you could call it that. This is what accountants say. The reality of it is we have to display on the face of the financial statement what we believe on the balance sheet, basically, which says this is what I own and this is what I owe. Those are the two pieces. And it is wrong to say I own something worth X dollars when you know it's not worth X. And the way that you change what X is you do, quote unquote, you do a write down. You basically credit the asset account, you debit an expense account, usually you called write down or loss in value, whatever you want to call it. You basically shift that debit that was sitting in the balance sheet as an asset to an expense and it's gone. Under the example I gave you, that's exactly what would happen. And it's just a term of art to, in the end, when people sign off and make representations, and what auditors come in to do is to actually validate, one, that you followed authoritative guidance, but are the things on the face of the financial statements, are they materially, they never say they're accurate, but are they materially accurate? They do their tests to make sure they're materially accurate. And so that is how you, if you've got an asset that didn't wear down, I had mentioned the three types of accounting transactions, right? I mean, if the federal government came in eminent domain and took it, you would actually record $5 million. You would do the write down. There's a real transaction. In the meantime, the second one I said is recognition of depreciation or amortization. That's where you write down the value of year over year because the asset's basically wearing out, right? So you'd have a combination of those two, and they would flow through. I hope through all of that I answered your question. If not, try again.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And then one project in mind that's fairly controversial is the Ambler Mining Road. It started out as a DOT project, and I think it was $8 million shifted to ADA for surveys for things like that. Would that have value to it? Because it's, I guess, you know, the idea would be if a private entity wanted to come in and build the road or something like that, does that contain a bookable value?
It through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it does. And that's actually one of the ones we have conversations about, is there still value there? And in fact, specifically, I can tell you the discussions are is that, well, the legislature intended for this to happen. The legislature passed it. They appropriated money for it. The governor's office has approved it. And we are moving forward with the assumption that should a route be found that meets all the intent and everything else, all of the value of all those permits and all of that work to get from point A to point B have value, because it is the short answer is that is an asset, because you're basically you're going through and paying for those things that would be necessary either to build the road or whatever it is, the EIS studies, the permitting, the engineering. I mean, all of that stuff is like, but for the fact you want to build that road, you would not have incurred that cost. And because the reason that you incurred that cost is to end up with an asset, it becomes part of the basis of that asset until it's determined that you don't have an asset.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments from committee members? Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think my question, based on the last questioning, so is there a point in time that you have an asset that you could, in fact, write down and it becomes, so as a record of decision wears out, as the EIS study wears out, you know, you've not done anything with it, so it has expired, maybe is a better word to say. Is there a point in time that you take the cost of those EISs or record of decisions or whatever, and you back them out because they have now since expired, and as the asset becomes less and less over time if you don't do anything with it? Is there a point that you do back that out?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Gaddis. If I said that right.
Yeah.
Indeed. In fact, and since Representative Kawasaki brought up Ambler, that is one of the questions, even with Susitna, and there were, and I apologize, I remember, it seems like administrative order, when the governor put Susitna on halt and put Ambler on halt. Part of that had to do with, it's like, well, there is a shelf life. That is the term I use in the control. There's a shelf life to those EIS studies that at some point they have no value. And part of, I think, ADA and AEA's communications were to the governor's offices, okay, but we have spent this money. There is a shelf life. We need to finish some of this stuff. So at least it isn't like it just dies immediately, but it does have a shelf life, and you want to at least finish it so that should you decide to move forward, you haven't lost all of that value. And the question gets to be that I and the controller, because we are the ones that sign the letter of representation that says the values, especially as it's an asset, are fairly represented. And a lot of things aren't just black and white. There is a lot of subjectivity to it of what you think and don't think is going to happen. But in this particular instance, and even in Susitna, it's just like, well, at this point, the legislature has not said stop. And so there's still value, we think. At some point, there may not be. But the short answer to your question is that absolutely things that have a shelf life like that, at some point when they do not have a value, they have to be written down. Otherwise, you're essentially misstating the value of your assets, and you're falsifying your financials.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there any further questions or comments, Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more on the – so the future unrealized gains or losses. The example you gave us on the 1040 was essentially losses, I guess. So going forward, you don't anticipate – since it could be gains or losses, you don't anticipate it the dividend being – any larger, any smaller, I guess, then is that it'll be basically it'll be flatter, though. Is that right?
Through the chair, this It's almost two questions. What I do think is that if the dividend, and let's just say straight across the board is 50%, I think over the whole life, the 25 years, the average is like 47%. I mean, it's almost at 50% for that whole 25-year period. If the dividend is based on, let's just say, 50% of what that green line was, it swings, you could see, from year to year, but it's not as much. When you throw GASB 31 in, which is really the end, the audited financial statements, and there's no exclusion right now under the current language, then you could see how much it swings. So it does, I think, to your second question, flatten out a little bit. And that's the whole, in that one slide that I showed, this, our goal is, you know, is to share what we're here for. It's the, besides doing all the job creation, those other things, but to provide some stability and predictability too. So in fact, it should do that. To the other thing I think that you were saying, and if I don't have this right, correct me and I'll try to respond differently, but it isn't necessarily, the answer isn't necessarily linear that you end up at the same exact dividend amount over a period of time if you net all of those things out. First, you still have the issue of when can you write the check? Do you have the wherewithal, right? Back to why the analogy is so good as cash-based taxpayers, that you write a check because you got the money, and if you didn't write a check, you need to explain why. When I was at the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the investments that we made there were, it's always in government safety, liquidity, and yield, right? Boy, it's just really bad to lose government money. So safety. But generally, most investment, just like ADA has an investment resolution for externally and internally managed funds, they're very usually pretty safe types of assets, right, that you would invest in. So then you really look to liquidity of when you go out and buy. I have $10 million. I need that $10 million back in 60 days. And I go out and say, for all the things we're authorized to buy, that's what I want back. In that scenario, if I was at the Fairbanks North Star Borough, I think I'm pretty sure I could say with some confidence that may ebb and flow over time, but I think the net number would turn out to be the same in the end. Mm-hmm. But the difference for us, for ADA, and it would be probably for HFC or anyone else, but the difference for us is that we have two outside entities that do externally manage investments for us, and they buy and sell, actually. They don't just hold for maturity purposes. They buy and sell, and their average life is somewhere around 5 years when you put it all together. And so in that circumstance, I cannot tell you that it would turn out to be the same, because they're buying and selling, and the timing of that for what's going on in the market changes things. So,
great. Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, just to sum this up, maybe you can tell me if this is an accurate statement or not, but what I think I hear you saying, in amongst all the different activities that happen throughout a calendar year for ADA, is basically to go to number three, sentence two, where it says, language changes better connect the payment to the actual realized results of the operation. So essentially, you'd be paying your dividend off of your audited financial statements, right, with all these GASB requirements taken out. I mean, isn't it that simple?
We pay off the audited results adjusted for these items, yes.
If this bill becomes law.
So. Exactly, which is why I thought, sorry, through the chair, Representative, which is why the analogy of, you know, if we as individuals had to go in and say, how much did our wealth increase? Look at your statement at 12/31/14. Look at your broker statement at 12/31/15, and then you include that gain or loss. You take all that stuff out, and that's exactly. So the short of what you're saying is I think, correct. So
the unrealized gains and unrealized losses are taken out.
Yep, that's the mark-to-market.
Representative Edgman.
So essentially that would put you on equal footing as a public-private entity with a private sector corporation, right? Because private sector corporations pay their dividends from audited financial statements.
They do. through the chair, Representative, they do. The difference is that they also, then FASB, Financial Accounting Standard Boards, which is for private side, right, they have mark-to-market stuff too, so it's not unusual. It's just, it's the question really gets to be is the, and there are reasons. So I think I said at one hearing that I'm not demonizing these. There's a reason government accounting standard boards have these adjustments. But the question gets to be as a legislative body, right, do you really want these to be part of the dividend calculation, you know, that makes that audited number up? Or do you think for purposes of the dividend, it should, these certain things should be excluded? Just like you exclude the money that we give you for a project, we want you to not include. It is part of the audited financial statement. We show those revenues. Just like the other thing is, the other big number on there is the dividends we pay to the state. It's like, well, you shouldn't reduce the current year's operations by the fact that we're paying a dividend, which shows up on ADA's books as an expense. That is an audited representation. That's taken out too. So I think that short, if I understand you right, Representative, that you, I think you are essentially correct in your understanding what I've been trying to say.
If I may just
Representative Edgman.
In closing, I think this bill is a good bill. I think it makes good sense to me, and I'd like to see the bill go through. Thanks.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, but you have me on the bill's merits and so forth, and at the risk of going too long, just can you say how much discretion is there in determining what dividend ADA pays to the state? Is there any discretion whatsoever?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the per statute, ADA is required to pay a dividend, and that dividend is 25, no less than 25%, no more than 50% of the statutorily defined net income.
So that's quite a range.
Yeah, that is quite a range.
It is a range. But to my prior comment that, you know, historically, again, over 25 years, that number is it's either 47 or 48%. We calculate it because, well, maybe somebody will ask, you know, and so generally, it's always been pretty much at the almost at the 50%, and I think ADA, quite frankly, is well, I'm proud of what ADA does. I mean, and we're only talking the dividend component here. It's too bad you can't put numbers to all of the jobs that are created and all of the financings that are done, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. So.
So through the chair to follow up.
Representative Sadler.
So there is some discretion, but someone has exercised that discretion to be much closer to 50% than 25%. So what are the criteria in that the board uses in determining that dividend amount?
There actually is. Gosh, thank you for asking. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. This is actually an extract from, I've been packing this around for a couple months now, so I finally get to use it. This is an extract from the December 19th memo to the board resolution. Specifically says, ADA's mission is established by statute. The authority was created by the legislature as a public corporation to advance the economic prosperity of Alaskans by diversifying the Alaska economy, promoting the creation and retention of Alaska jobs. The dividend did not change the authority's mission. In fact, in establishing the dividend requirement, the legislature stated its intent that the financial integrity of the authority remains secure so the authority can continue to fulfill its vital economic development mission for the state. Thus, the legislature made clear that although a dividend must be made available, the dividend must not be determined in a manner that does not impede the authority's ability to fulfill its mission. And with this background in mind, the staff believes the board must counterbalance two competing interests. Provide an adequate financial return to the state in the form of a cash dividend, as contemplated by the state, versus ensure the authority retains the financial capability to achieve its economic development mission for the state. So those two, ADA, as I look at ADA, is very much like the feds, that the feds have the employment counterbalanced against inflation. Sometimes those are competing. ADA has a submission, really employment, we use the word jobs, but it has employment and economic activity balanced against providing financing for development projects. In doing that financing, we are also to be self-sustaining, which we are, and we are to pay a dividend. And so those are the things that are given consideration. Can we pay as large of a dividend as possible without jeopardizing our ability to do our mission and have the cash? I mean, in short, when I have to go to the board and I say, here's what I think it can be or can't be, it's based upon the cash projections in the future that I think that we are okay for all the things that I know at that point in time, all the projects, all the loans, everything that's have come to us that we've made commitments on. We have bond covenants, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Is there any other comments from committee? Seeing none, Mr. Lamb, any closing comments?
My apologies for not following protocol, Mr. Chair, as best I could. But we think it's a good, well, you've known me for a long time. I think this is the right thing to do. I've tried to explain as best I can, and I appreciate the support.
Okay, thank you. I like the bill myself. But at this time, we are putting House Bill 268 aside. We'll be bringing it back for further comment and hopefully passage. So with that, our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Thursday, March 17th, 2016 at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we will be hearing House Bill 226, Extend Alaska Commission on Aging, and House Bill 222, Increase of Appropriation Item. And with that, at 3:15 p.m., we are adjourned.